Welcome to the Humergence Dialogues, where we examine individual, group, and social emergence from a Gravesian developmental perspective. This is Natasha Todorovic, and our guest today has intimate knowledge of the South African emergence and struggle out of apartheid.
We're delighted to be speaking with Eleanor Sisulu. She's a biographer, historian, and author. Her book, Walter and Albertina Sisulu, In Our Lifetime, tells a people's story of the social, political, and cultural transformation of South Africa. The account is detailed, it's lucid, it's breathtaking, and it's impeccably researched. Eleanor, it's a great treat to be speaking with you. Welcome.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure speaking to you, too.
Nelson Mandela, in the foreword of your book, wrote that if South Africa were to be given the choice of one life story to be told, that story would be Walter Sisulu's. Would you tell us about the Sisulus and why Mr. Mandela considered them so important?
Yes. Well, Walter Sisulu was considered one of the architects of modern South Africa, in that he was among the pioneering group which transformed the ANC, and he was behind many of the great campaigns in the 1950s, which transformed the ANC from a small elite organization of very highly educated people to a mass movement, which was able eventually to challenge the government and through its struggles in apartheid. He was born in 1912, and by the time he was, and then he migrated to Johannesburg in the 1930s. I think what distinguished him from other ANC leaders like Mandela and Tambo was that he was from a working class background, peasant background, and he never went to university, so he was not part of the educated elite. He was very much, he worked in a variety of jobs, so he had the common touch, and he was able to bring people together. He was considered the kingmaker of the ANC. For example, he recruited Nelson Mandela to the ANC. He recruited Oliver Tambo, and he recruited a whole range of people who became very prominent in the ANC. So, in other words, he was a major kingmaker, and he was also...
When you say kingmaker, are you in some way implying that he supported these people, he nurtured them, created... How did he do that?
Well, for example, when Mandela came to him, Mandela had just recently run away from his uncle, who was the regent prince of the Tembo. The Tembo clan in Eastern Cape, what was then the Transkei. And Mandela had run away and come to Johannesburg as a young man and was having difficulty establishing himself. And Walter encouraged him to join the ANC, encouraged him to further his law studies, and even bought him a suit when he graduated. And Mandela would always come to his home for meals, and it was like a home away from home. And I think the same applied to Oliver Tambo and a whole lot of other people. When I was writing the book, people would often say to me, oh, I did this because of your father-in-law. The reason I did this was because of Walter. So people, he's been described as a quiet engine of the ANC. In another comparison, a journalist said Mandela was the star and Sisulu was the producer. So that was the relationship he had. He worked behind the scenes, and he got things happening. He put people together. He had his huge network and introduced people. And he was very sensitive to the capabilities of people. For example, he looked at Mandela and said, this is a young man that's going to go far, and encouraged him. And he was much senior to Mandela. And yet when Mandela's star rose, and it was clear that Mandela had the charisma to become this great leader, he accepted that. I mean, he accepted and nurtured him into that role. Someone else may have seen him as a competitor instead. So that was the kind of person he was. And the same with Albertina, his wife, who was born in 1918, the same year as Mandela, and she came to Transkei in the 1940s. He also nurtured her, and he helped her explain the political situation to her, encouraged her to take part in political activity. And one of the things that he was known for was education. he always stressed that people must get an education and encourage people to study, even though he himself never went far, at least in formal education.
Well, when you described him, you described him as somebody very brilliant and very insightful, and that despite his lack of formal education, people really saw him as this great intellectual force.
Yes, you know, there's the thing about emotional intelligence. In those days, people didn't talk about emotional intelligence. So when they would assess the impact that he had on the movement and on the people, people would see it as an anomaly, that here was this man who didn't go far in school, but he became this powerful force and influenced the lives of so many people and commanded the respect of so many people. But looking at it now, one can say he had emotional intelligence. He was not academically inclined, but he had an understanding of life. He had an understanding of relationships between people. He had the understanding of the way people's egos work. For example, in the way he confronted people, he had a very clear idea that, for example, he would never ever dress someone down in front of other people. He would never engage in personally attacking someone. And even when he did get angry and in a confrontational situation, he always treated people with respect. So I think it was that understanding of human nature and psychology which helped him to become what he was, and that different kind of intelligence, which I think was enormously useful to the ANC.
And so in a way you're saying he saw more in situations, saw more in other people, saw more than they even saw in themselves.
Yes, yes, because like Mandela says it very clearly in his biography when he talks about how he was young and very impetuous and confrontational. And one time they were in a meeting situation and they were arguing about something, and this particular person was very much opposed to what they were proposing. And Walter kind of said, okay, he was quite conciliatory, and then he said to Mandela, let's talk about this later. Then he spoke to him afterwards and he said, you know, the main person in that group was so-and-so. So we'll talk to him separately. And they talked to that person out of the group and eventually managed to push their position through. So I think the thing about not being confrontational unless absolutely necessary, finding different ways to reach people, I think those were the influences. Certainly he had a big influence on making Mandela much more analytical and less hot-headed than he was as a young man in his 20s.
Mm-hmm. People look at individual heroes, and Nelson Mandela is certainly one of the heroes that many people cite. And outside of South Africa, the name of Walter Sisulu isn't really that well known for his role in ending apartheid and transforming South Africa. You could have given your father-in-law the hero treatment that many people give to Mandela. Instead, what you chose to do was to talk about a couple, and more than that, a family working in the struggle against apartheid. Can you explain how and why you decided to do this, how you came to do it, and why you chose to write their biography?
Yes, well, precisely the reason that Mandela's is a name that is the symbol of the struggle, and it's very easy to forget the other names. And in fact, Mandela himself is very conscious of this, and that's why he said that Walter Sisulu's story should be told, that it's the stories of many, many people. And sometimes when you focus on one person, you actually lose. It's like this one person is this outstanding hero, and you lose track of a sense of a movement in which many countless number of people, many of them unknown, have contributed. And for me, what fascinated me about the Sisulu story was how rooted in the community they were, how rooted in their family, and the collective approach to leadership and to decision making. It was very striking. Albertina Sisulu as well focused very much on building organizations, building up from the ground, and a lot of consultation. So they had a very consultative approach to leadership, which I think is a useful lesson for young people. The idea of the family as an institution, and also not the family in the nuclear sense, but a wider family.
Yeah, can you actually talk a little bit more about that? Because what's so striking, I heard you interviewed on the BBC and also in this book, is how you talk about the whole family being involved in the struggle. And also the notion of family is very different than it is here in America.
Yes, well, if you look at the 1930s and 1940s, when there was a big influx of black people into urban areas in South Africa, largely as a result of increased industrial development after the Second World War, and or during the Second World War at least, there was an increased, more factories being built, and an increase in industrial development, which required a larger workforce. And so a lot of people, black people, there was a migration to urban areas. And during that time, the housing for black people was just not there. So there was overcrowding in the cities. And people relied on networks, social and familial networks. And, for example, Walter's home became a center for people from the Transkei who were, you know, it was kind of like my homeboy, my homegirl kind of arrangement. And families then were defined not only just your blood relatives, but relatives by marriage, as well as people who came from the same place. So in fact, people grew up with people as family members who were actually had no blood relationship at all. And I think Walter and Albertina were exponents of this kind of outlook, because many people who they have very, very close connections with over a long period of time. For example, there was one man who, a father who was having problems with his son, and he literally gave him to Walter and said, you know, you take charge of this young man. And this young man stayed in the house and grew up as a member of the family. So they had their own biological children, and then they raised many other children.
And that wasn't really unusual or infrequent, was it? Because kids sort of moved and lived with aunts and uncles and then
yes.
Kind of went... I found that whole family relationship very intriguing.
Yes, it wasn't unusual. Because of the housing situation, there was no way that people could be... People had to accommodate a lot of people. But also people relied on each other for getting jobs. They relied on each other for childcare. You know, you had multi-generational households. You never had a situation in black families where you had just mother, the father, and the children. So you had very much a situation of an extended family.
So it was very much like the village raising the
yes,
children.
The village situation was reproduced in the city. Of course, which had its problems, because when you have overcrowding often and poverty, often you have conflict. But in Walter's case, there was the biological family. His own mother lived with him. And his sister, even after she married, continued to remain a part of their household. And her two children, because her marriage was unhappy, her two children actually grew up more under Walter's care and Albertina's care than under his own sister. So that by the time she died, those children were already so much a part of the household. And, you know, they were brothers and sisters. They never used the word cousins. Even to this day, they don't call each other cousins. They call each other brothers and sisters, which can be quite confusing, because if people ask me how many children did they have, I have to always say 5 biological and then 11 or more, which they raised. So that was the way that they lived, and I think they were incredibly generous, both of them. They paid school fees for a number of children when they could afford it, who were not their own. And I think they also benefited, because when Walter went to jail, people came forward and helped the family. They helped Albertina. And she always tells a story about how she had no food, and she came home one day and the kids were saying, you know, we are so hungry, there's no food. And she went into the bedroom to pray. And then they called they came and they said to her, "There's someone wants to see you." So she reluctantly got up, and it was a neighbor who came and just gave her 10 rand, which in those days, that value was equivalent to like $10. So she was able to buy food for her children. And she always tells the story about how stories about how people helped her in difficult times. It's a pity that that kind of cooperation and whatnot seems to be dying away in South Africa as people become more westernized in their approach and outlook.
So it's becoming much more like the American model of the nuclear family, even one-parent households?
Well, with the middle class, yes, people are moving towards that. And well, we've not got to that stage yet, but certainly the more people are becoming more nuclear, you don't have that kind of huge extended family. Well, it's more varied, but it's not uncommon now to have more nuclear kind of arrangements.
That's a great loss. It makes me feel sad.
Yes, it is very unfortunate. I mean, a lot of things are happening in the society, which I think are cause for great concern. For example, you have increased incidence of child abuse. Now, people debate about that and say, well, it's not that there's increased incidence, it's that it's been reported more often.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I really don't believe it. I think that, and if you can tell from people's memories, I remember a childhood where I played freely in the neighborhood, and if I did anything bad, people were staying 10 streets away would come and tell my mother, and we were quite safe to move around, and yet that's not the case now. And in fact, that's one of the things Albertina is always very, very distressed about, that the levels of child abuse in the society.
So she's noticed quite a difference then.
Yes, because with the kind of close familial arrangements, you know, child abuse was not something which was common. So, and abandoned children. Of course, there were orphanages and things, but I think the rate in which children are getting abandoned, I think it's really cause for concern.
And so, to what do you and Albertina attribute that to? Is that the change in culture, change in values, change in outlook?
Yeah, I think there's been, you know, change in values. I think it's a more permissive society, and I think people haven't achieved the balance between, like Albertina talks about when she grew up, how very strict as girls, they were controlled, and rules were very strict in school about interaction between boys and girls. I think we moved from that strict Victorian kind of way of living in Southern Africa to the opposite end of the spectrum, where there's too little boundaries. I think from a situation where boundaries were very rigid as to how people needed to behave and how they needed to conduct themselves in social situations, now we have moved to a situation where there are less and less boundaries. And in a kind of, I think, a way which is sometimes unhealthy. I think the influence of television, influence of globalization, trends from elsewhere, but also the dislocation of family life caused by apartheid over a long period of time. You know, we're still sowing the seeds of that dislocation. I think in any society, urbanization leads to enormous disruption.
Mm-hmm.
But with apartheid, there was a particular way in which societies responded, and the kind of, especially among the youth, I think it caused severe disruption and dislocation in families and communities.
Can you talk more about what life was like for people under apartheid?
Okay, yeah, it's interesting that now, like my children, for example, they just simply can't imagine how life is. I remember going once with my child into a supermarket, and he was 3 years old, and he was engaging in a conversation with the white man in the supermarket, asking him, "Do you own this shop? What's your name?" And, it was so amusing, but I just thought a child of an earlier generation would never have just had the confidence to walk into a shop, speak to a white person in that way. It just wouldn't have happened. I think that, it's the issue of living a very restricted, your opportunities from the outset are completely circumscribed unless you leave the country. You can't go into certain careers. I remember from Zimbabwe, once I left university, Zimbabwe was independent already. When I went to South Africa, seeing this job column and jobs being described as saying whites only, whites only, whites only, and seeing park benches, whites only, cinemas, beaches, that kind of segregation was quite devastating.
So part of your life was in that era as well, so you sort of have that before and after view.
Well, yes, I grew up with the memory of that. You know, we never in Zimbabwe had the extent of segregation that we had under apartheid, but there was certainly segregation there, and one incident that sticks out in my mind was a time when, on Guy Fawkes Day, when you have firework displays, and there was people, we lived in a block of flats, and there was a firework display. People were setting off fireworks, and there was one called a jumping jack, which my brother seemed to jump, and, sometimes if you were in its path, it seemed to be jumping towards you. And my brother ran away, and in trying to run away from this thing, he gashed his head onto a corner of a gate. So he was, had this blood pouring from his head. So my mother, we had no phones in the neighborhood, so my mother rushed to a, call it in America, a gas station, a distance away, to call the doctor. And we went with her, and when we got there, there had been an accident on the road, and there was a black man with his leg hanging by, literally by a piece of skin. And the doctor had stopped and was attending to him, and the police had come. And the doctor was telling the police that, look, if you get him into your car now, you can get him into the hospital in time to save his leg. If you don't, then the police said, no, you must wait for the ambulance. We can't do it. You have to wait for the ambulance from the African hospital. And an ambulance from the white hospital had come, and it had turned back and gone back. So this man was bleeding to death, and the doctor said he's bleeding to death. You cannot leave him like this. And they refused. And eventually the doctor put him in his own car and went to the hospital. And that remains vividly in the mind. That was the kind of experience that we grew up with.
And that was common. That wasn't an exception.
Yes, it was common. It was common. Because I come from an interracial family. One of my aunts was married to someone from Holland. And when her children were involved in an accident one time, because they had different complexions, one was taken to one hospital and the other was taken to the other hospital. So she had to be rushing around to different hospitals looking for her children.
Wow.
So, these were experiences that we grew up with. So when I wrote the biography, I understood very well what kind of trauma and distress was caused by apartheid.
Yeah, you used a lot of those different examples in your book. When we talk about spiral dynamics, we use it as an analytical tool. We talk about life conditions. And what you're describing with apartheid is that it was a life condition. But also in your book, you show that it wasn't something that just kind of popped up and it came up one day like a street light and people got tired of it and then it came down the next day.
Mm-hmm.
You go through how it developed, how it progressed, how it got more and more restrictive. Some of the things that you cite were laws that were shaping South Africa, like the 1913 Native Land Act or the 1934 Slum Clearance Act or the 1963 General Laws Amendment and these sorts of things. What were some of these things, and how did how were they shaped? I mean, what kinds of mindsets and attitudes could make these laws, enforce them, and how did they in turn shape and change the people and the culture that they were intended to control?
Well, the Land Act was the foundation. It set the foundation for apartheid because it divided the land so that black people were confined to about 13% of the total land area and the rest was for white people. And it enshrined the notion that black people were strangers in South Africa.
So did they take land away from black people?
Yes, people were removed en masse. And you have this wonderful book by Saul Plucky, who was a very one of the early ANC leaders and also quite a genius in his own right. He was a journalist and a writer. And he wrote about the Land Act and the impact it had and talked about families having to be pushed, who were pushed out of the land and having to traveling, like, you know, reduced to refugee situation virtually.
And that's what pushed a lot of people into the cities, wasn't it?
Yes, that pushed people into the cities and it pushed people. I mean, people, as Saul Plucky said, they became strangers on their own land, in the land of their birth, because they had to move from these areas which were designated as white to the areas which were confined as native land. And they could only be on the white land if they had a pass. So that's where you had the pass laws, which people protested against.
Can you explain the pass laws?
Yeah, the pass laws meant that you as a black person were only entitled to be in what were called the native areas, which were defined by the Land Act, the Native Land Act and subsequent acts. So if you were out of that, the only reason you would be out of that area as a black person was if you're working for a white person. I mean, there were certain conditions under which you could be. So there were all kinds of permits, but there were certain categories of black people who were allowed to be in the cities or in what were designated as white areas. So you had to carry a pass which gave an indication that you had a right to be, that you were either working or that you were a child of someone who was working there. So it was a very, very demeaning thing for people to have to produce their passes. And for decades, people fought against it, and people were arrested en masse under the pass laws.
Walter had a sort of an unusual approach to that, didn't he? Could you explain it?
It was one of the things which he said he hated the most and which caused him to enter politics was humiliation of the pass laws.
And do I recall correctly, he didn't need to have a pass?
No, he could have got away with having a pass because his father was white, he was light-skinned, and people who were of mixed race, if they got themselves classified as people of mixed race, they didn't need to have passes. So he could have if he had wanted to.
But he chose to take a pass.
Not to. He chose. He said he couldn't get himself classified as a person of mixed race.
Because he felt it was unjust, didn't he?
Yes, he felt that it was unjust, and it was really the cornerstone of apartheid in his view, and that it was something that should be fought at all costs. Now, the pass laws, from 1913, they had tried to extend the pass laws to women, because the pass laws apply to African men, but not to women. That was mainly because it was men who were migrating to work in the urban areas. But the women resisted the pass laws. In 1913, they resisted the pass laws, 1920s. And then in the 1950s, they had big demonstrations against the pass laws. And people like Albertina and Winnie Mandela were arrested during those demonstrations.
Well, you know, that was another very interesting part of your book, how the whole family was involved in the struggle. It wasn't just the men, it wasn't just the women, it was whole families fighting against this. Do you attribute that to that close connection and networking among families, or how did that sort of thing happen?
Well, that was one thing, the closeness of families. But I think the other thing was that apartheid was so all-encompassing. I mean, you couldn't be a black person and not experience apartheid in some aspect of your life. It really just wasn't possible. You know, if you were a man, you were subjected to past laws, you were subjected to humiliation in the workplace. If you were a woman, you had difficulty in getting housing, or your prospects of getting jobs, you were confined to either nursing or teaching, and even then, black nurses and black teachers, the conditions were very different from white ones. If you were a child, your schooling was affected by the Bantu Education Act in 1954, and that really was another galvanizing issue for black communities, because when the apartheid government said that black children should be educated for their station in life, they should be educated to be hewers of wood and drawers of water, therefore they shouldn't do subjects like mathematics, and they tried to change and dumb down the curriculum for black people. Of course, it caused enormous outrage in the black community, and so even the most apolitical people couldn't just live their lives and ignore this kind of legislation. You know, the legislation touched every aspect of life, and so therefore I think it was impossible for people not to become involved in some way or the other.
As you tell the story, it sounds like an account from another world. It doesn't sound like that it's possible that people treat one another like that.
Unfortunately, it is.
Yeah.
They still do in many ways. I mean, for example, you get a situation in Zimbabwe today which, you know, was supposed to have been a free country, and Zimbabweans are supposed to look forward to a future which is different from the past. And yet you get a government which is doing the very same thing that the previous white settler government did. And unfortunately, I think if people see a particular way in which power is wielded through force, through control, through undemocratic means, it tends to get replicated. Even sometimes the oppressed will replicate the... It's like an abused child will, mm-hmm. not always, but often, grow up to be an abuser.
Yeah.
I think that's what happens with human beings.
I was talking to a young white South African man. His family moved back to the UK when he was in his early 20s. And we had a bit of a conversation. One of his comments really surprised me. What he said was that he never knew what was going on outside the gates of his own community. When he got back to England, he started reading books about South Africa and said that he just couldn't believe that what he was reading about was the very same country that he had been living in. Can you talk about that? Was that typical of whites in South Africa? Was the separation between people that distinct that somebody living there wouldn't know what was going on?
Well, certainly, because the state had total control over the media. So therefore, you would not, unless you were an inquisitive person or were exposed to political influences outside your family, you could live your life and not experience anything of what the vast majority of people are experiencing. And whites were deliberately sheltered. You had the South African Broadcasting Corporation, which was very powerful and very controlling, and edited the news. And, of course, at that time you had no internet, you had no cable TV. It was just South African Broadcasting Corporation. You know, there was no such thing as blogging or email or whatever. It's the type of thing Robert Mugabe is trying to do today in Zimbabwe. And he can't succeed because there's internet and there's... So no matter how he controls state media, you'll always have media from outside. But this is what was the situation under apartheid, where there was total control over the media. And then also people who were dissidents in the white community, from their point of view, people who expressed a different opinion, you know, either had to go into exile or ended up in jail or ended up being very isolated in the community, were not able to get jobs, became pariahs. So the punishment for actually thinking outside the box was very, very severe. And for whites who defied, who questioned apartheid and interrogated and defied the values of the community, the punishment was quite harsh. And, you know, often they would be very isolated, whereas among black people in some ways, you know, everybody was against apartheid. So, you know, you could never be alone.
Hmm.
But there were whites who suffered, you know, through a small minority who actually suffered a lot. And, you know, the vast majority of white people, many supported apartheid actively. Many were just didn't have the backbone to defy it. But many were just completely ignorant. And it is possible. I mean, even in South Africa today, it's possible you get Sandton, which is next to Alexandra. People can live in Sandton, which is the very affluent middle class. You can live in Sandton and be completely oblivious to Alexandra, which is a very poor and deprived neighborhood.
Sort of like the characterization of the young boy who was living in the slum in Tsotsi.
Yes, I didn't watch Tsotsi, but I read the book, which was based on the book by Ethel Fugard, which was written in, I think, in 1961. And yes, certainly, you know, and it's been pointed out, Alistair Sparks is one of the South African writers who has pointed out, as a journalist, he used to go out into the townships, be covering riots and demonstrations and people being killed, and then go home and his wife is playing tennis on the court with her friends, and it's all peaceful. I mean, even now you go to the wealthiest part of Johannesburg and the poorest surrounding areas, and the contrast is absolutely huge.
Mm-hmm. Just like living in different worlds within miles of one another.
Yeah. And I think to some extent, I mean, you have that all over the world. I mean, you have here in the U.S. neighborhoods which are so vastly different from each other, where life expectancies, conditions of life, opportunities are hugely different. There's huge disparities. But I think in South Africa, it's more stark, and the middle class is small, and the vast majority of people living in very difficult conditions. And unfortunately, it's very difficult to change that. It's very difficult to change the spatial arrangements of apartheid. You had people leaving at 4 in the morning to go to work in the city, arrive there at 7, and then they leave at 5, and they come back, I mean, get home at 8. Now, it's very difficult to change that without some massive housing programs, massive social expenditure, social investment.
You make a very interesting point with that, in that apartheid created a system, and that system still exists today as a result of that historical social programming, economic programming, and physical separation of people, hasn't it?
Yes, and it's very difficult to change it. Now the system becomes not one of color, but of economics. So you have what people are calling economic apartheid. And, you know, you have to consciously try and change it. And I think this is one of the main things that the current South African government is grappling with. How do you change that system, and how do you uplift materially disadvantaged communities, and at the same time allow for the growth of a black middle class, but without increasing disparities and increasing resentment?
So you're looking at how do you change things today, but also as a historian, you're writing about the history of how this happened. Can you talk about a little bit about why history is important? And also, in your book, you write that Walter was also concerned about transmitting knowledge to the next generation. Can you talk about the importance of history in relation to changing issues of today?
Yes, because you can't really understand and grapple with the problems of today without some kind of historic perspective. Certainly in South Africa, for example, if you're an urban planner in South Africa, you have to grapple with these realities. And you have to see what the apartheid project was and what it sought to do. But you also then have to deal with the fact that people have a particular mindset. So now even the black middle class that moves into formerly white suburbs don't want sub-economic housing next to them. So it affects that. Or in education, I mean, we've had a history of a horrible kind of education, Christian national education for the whites, Bantu education for the blacks. And you have to deal with that history, and now to correct it, you need to produce new books, you need to retrain teachers. Even the education system, if you think of it, you've got millions of teachers who were trained in a particular way, and they grew up with the belief ingrained into them that blacks are inferior and whites are superior. And so they have to deal with now that mindset being changed. And, you know, it's easy to change laws and rules, but it's very difficult to change people's attitudes. So, you know, this is an ongoing thing, and I think that the ravages of apartheid, the consequences of it, will continue into next couple of generations at least.
Because it takes that long to change mindsets and values and culture and beliefs, doesn't it?
Yeah, it takes very long. I mean, in some areas you can get change happening quite rapidly, but in some areas, you can't. I mean, South Africa has. It's been amazing how from 1994... the kind of change, and the fact that the stage was set for very vicious conflict in South Africa, and I think through wise leadership and through compromises on all sides, that kind of bloody confrontation was averted. But we still are dealing with the consequences of that kind of system.
Well, with the ongoing historical repression that really built up a mindset, and just because, as you say, you turn the laws around, it doesn't end it suddenly, does it?
No.
Can you talk a little bit about what the pressures were that forced the de Klerk government to release Walter Sisulu, Nelson Mandela, and the others held on Robben Island, and what changed? I mean, what, I guess people think that apartheid kind of ended when they were released, but what created the change, and how do you think that some of those mindsets are going to be turned around in the future?
Well, the pressure that built up over the years, there was, for one thing, the rejuvenation of the ANC. There were the protests inside the country throughout the 1960s, the 1970s, the diplomatic work of the ANC, which and the PAC, which resulted in the pressure by the anti-apartheid movement. I think the work of many, many people, both inside and outside South Africa, the support by certain countries, like the Scandinavian countries, supported the anti-apartheid movement very strongly. Then there was, in the 1970s, you had the independence of Mozambique and Angola, which put a lot of pressure on South Africa's borders. And then in the 1980s, the independence of Zimbabwe. So you had, South Africa was surrounded by hostile black governments and also governments which were prepared to support the ANC. So that put a lot of pressure, and it gave impetus to the ANC's armed struggle. Then inside the country you had increased pressure, protests against, I think the education issue was a major issue in 1976. Young people protested against the imposition of Afrikaans as a medium of instruction, and those protests escalated into what is known as the Soweto Uprising, which became countrywide. So you had young, very young people, a new generation, confronting the state. And that conflict resulted in many young people going into exile. Many of them found their way to the ANC, and there was a rejuvenation of the ANC. And then you had the Black Consciousness Movement, actually, which was part of what influenced the feelings that led up to the Soweto Uprising. The rise of the Black Consciousness Movement, Steve Biko was one of the major exponents of Black Consciousness. So you had that influence. You also had African-American influences, which were perhaps not as direct, but certainly people were inspired by Martin Luther King. They were inspired by the Black Panthers and Malcolm X, and these were you know, that this was literature which found its way into South Africa.
It's interesting that African Americans are now influenced and inspired by the whole anti-apartheid struggle and resistance as well. So it's sort of a mutual...
Yeah, the cross-fertilization.
Yeah.
Then you had one of the main things that also was in the 1980s, the rise of the UDF, the United Democratic Front, which was an umbrella organization of anti-apartheid movements and which people got involved right down to community level. So that had a lot of influence. Then the concerns economically, things became more difficult for South Africa, and pressure from, like in the US, you had the disinvestment, people pressuring for disinvestment, organizations like Trans Africa, American Committee on Africa, different organizations which really pressured for disinvestment. And I think the anti-apartheid movement did a lot. Also the rising star of Mandela and the publicity on Mandela, because he became a symbol, and a very powerful symbol. And people like Oliver Tambo, who really worked behind the scenes, did a lot of diplomatic work. And then the pressure within the continent of Africa, the OAU. And then, of course, you had the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, which also had an impact on some of the changes, because the Soviet Union, as it was transforming, they also, the relationship with the ANC changed, and they encouraged the ANC to get into a situation of negotiating a settlement.
So there were an incredible number of pressures internally, externally, politically, economically, socially, just all rising up and creating the inevitable outcomes, really.
Yes, yes.
I have another question for you, and it's I've been trying to figure out how to ask it. With your background in social development and economic development, I've heard people who would say something to this effect, that in 1946, blacks were not able to run South Africa, and that apartheid was a good thing because it allowed the development of people separate from one another. What would you say to someone who says that sort of a thing?
Well, you know, you've had those arguments throughout history. If you can, you know, injustice is injustice, and if you have a situation where people are cut out, I mean, you get that kind of argument now in some African countries where people don't want, leaders want to stay in power and they don't want to vote, well, don't want people to have free elections, and they'll use this justification. I think people always have the right, democratic right, to have a vote, regardless of their level of education. Because every, you know, that's what democracy is. And, you know, you can't have a situation where you say people aren't ready for democracy. So, you know, I think that was just used as justification to, because it's not as if the whites ran South Africa in a way which was fair to black people. It wasn't. So I think, you know, if you're talking about the rights of a human being, you have to apply them wherever in the world and in whatever period of time.
Well, in talking about some of the difficulties, the economic difficulties, how do you think that people can begin to bridge and close some of the educational, some of the economic gaps, some of the social and cultural gaps that are still existing?
Well, my personal belief is that the state has to, you have to subsidize education, or I shouldn't use the word subsidize, but rather, there has to be massive social investment into education and into health. You can't have a situation where you say, you know, like the World Bank kind of policies where the government said to cut down expenditure on education and health. You know, I think those are investments that have to be made. If you've had the level of poverty that you've had in South Africa, you also have to have, I think, the community development development at neighborhood level. You know, there's a lot of crime in South Africa. That's one of the big problems that we have. And, you know, ways of combating crime that need to be much more complex. And you have to have that social investment, even if just to combat crime. Because if you have people who feel a sense of hopelessness, who feel that they're never ever going to get a job, they're never ever going to... They're marginalized from birth just by virtue of being born in a certain area of the country, to a certain class of people, then they're never going to have any investment. And so, you know, that kind of social investment has to be done. And I think my belief is that investment in arts and culture is extremely important. You know, I don't go for the kind of narrow capitalist view that you must have growth and investment and, you know, everything will follow. Because I think if you're just going to focus on profit, an economy which is just profit-driven, which ignores the social complexity of the society, you have problems. The other major challenge in Southern Africa, not just South Africa, but in fact even in Africa generally, is the issue of the environment, environmental degradation, power and energy. You know, they've been, South Africa has relied a lot on coal energy, and also it has a nuclear energy power plant in Cape Town, which recently part of it had to shut down, and there were massive power cuts in Cape Town. And I just think that in the long term, our governments just have to look at solar energy as a viable source and other renewable sources of energy such as wind. So there's a whole environmental thing which we really haven't explored much. And of course there's the issue of HIV/AIDS, which is a huge, huge challenge to our societies. And that's something we're confronting and trying to deal with every day.
That's an incredible number of issues to be dealing with.
I even feel afraid when I mention them.
Yeah, well, you're talking about global issues. And issues that, as a people, humanity, we're going to really need to pay attention to, because we're no longer isolated.
Yes, yes.
And what happens in one part of the world affects another part of the world.
Yes, and I think the global warming, I mean, we're really facing that now. And, you know, when I think of the people who have been campaigning for the rainforest from the 1970s, and we didn't listen much to them at that period of time.
Yeah.
Now we're really confronted head-on with this thing.
Yeah.
It's become very much part of our lives.
Let me ask you a slightly different question. As you know, terrorism is a big deal in the U.S. right now. And this whole war on terrorism and anti-terrorism are really driving foreign policy in the U.S. Can you talk a little bit about South Africa's anti-terrorism laws in the 1960s and how they were used and what similarities you see?
Well, it's in a way, it's difficult to find similarities because the context, it was a different context. I think also who was defined as a terrorist in South Africa, you know, it's quite different from who is defined as a terrorist today. I mean, people who were defined as terrorists in South Africa at that time were people who had a very specific political goal, which was basically universal franchise and the democratic ideals, which were commonly stated Western values. And it was against the injustices and that kind of deprivation. I think what is defined as terrorism today is a much more complex situation. And so the South African terrorist laws were really to squash dissent among black population and to squash any organization which was moving towards demanding more political power. And it was really to entrench white hegemony and white domination. That's what it was about, a white minority controlling a black majority and keeping it in its place. Terrorism today is more complex, and it really is an issue about fundamentalism. And, you know, you have Islamic fundamentalism today, you have Christian fundamentalism, and when these clash, unfortunately, you get various forms of terrorism. Yeah, it's difficult to find an exact parallel, except anti-terrorism laws can be used in various ways to exert social control, so that, you know, you can have very broad definitions of people who are supposed to be terrorists, and which can encompass other people who don't have anything to do with terrorism, but by definition of belonging to a certain religion or a certain group, they become defined as potential terrorists. And, you know, you may want to not like what someone says or does, and by defining them in that particular way, then, you know, they get caught in this huge dragnet. So, you know, anti-terrorism laws, of course, they are necessary, but I think people need to be very vigilant as to how broad they are and how they are applied.
And is there any sort of a message that you would want to leave people with in regards to your book or your outlook or what you've learned as a result of going through the very long process of putting this book together?
Well, that history is very important. You know, we need to convey to future generations. It's absolutely important for children and young people to grow up with a sense of their past history and a sense of what people did before them. So that people just also don't look at life and look at the world in terms of, I mean, they appreciate the complexity of the world and the complexity of their societies, and don't look at it in terms of this kind of dichotomies. You know, the world is divided between Muslims and Christians, or between the West and the East. I think they need to appreciate the full complexity of life. And what I was trying to convey in my book was the complexity of political struggle over a long period of time and how these two people contributed to that struggle.
As you were speaking with people across the U.S. and as you've spoken to people in South Africa and across Europe, do you find that there's more of this kind of black-white, good-bad worldview, or do you find that more people are seeing the world as you'd like them to see it, as this much more complex thing?
You know, I feel sad that too often in our societies, people do have this kind of everything is reduced to simple dichotomies. And I find it in South Africa, one of the things that distresses me very much is that the ANC outlawed the death penalty. It, constitutionally, you cannot have the death penalty in South Africa. And I think this is a huge advance for a country in which was one of the highest rates of execution in the world. And yet, popularly, if there was a referendum today, chances are that people would vote for the death penalty, black and white. And you get people saying, oh, crime is so high in South Africa, we must bring back the death penalty. That's the immediate response to the high crime rate. And, you know, I feel so sad that this is a lack of appreciation of the complexity of the human psychology. The reasons for crime are very complex. Reasons especially for murder and things like that. And that the death penalty was not a solution during apartheid, and it's not a solution now. And to me, it's those kind of very stark fundamental ways of looking at it, which is common to all fundamentalisms, whether it be Islamic, Christian, Hindu, even certain political ideologies. You know, they simplify things in very complex situations, and the consequences for people can be quite disastrous.
And in a sense, that's the same difficulty you're having with your book, because people want it to be simple, they want it to be appealing to the lowest common denominator, and when you do that, you lose the complexity, don't you?
Yes, you do, and I think also people, because of the nature of the media today, people probably have shorter attention spans. They want the message to be simpler, shorter, more straightforward. And, you know, I've been surprised with the response here of U.S. publishers is that, you know, people don't know Walter Sisulu, they don't know Albertina Sisulu, therefore a book. And you would think that's precisely the reason why people would be interested in such a book, because they actually don't know. But I think people, as part of the global village we live in today, that people often want to remain in their own comfort zones and not be challenged to go outside. And that the people who do that are, unfortunately, I hope I'm wrong, but my perception is that such people are in the minority.
In the minority who want to search and who are curious and who want to look, yeah.
Who want to search, who want to interrogate, who want to, are open to an examination of the way they look at things, who want to go out of their own communities and experience life elsewhere, you know, who want to understand what is going on in the world. Unfortunately, I think such people are in a minority.
They must be drawn to your book, though. I mean, you're having a really wonderful reception to it here in the U.S.
Well, yes. I mean, there are people who have a deep interest in South Africa, who are doing work there, who have been interested in it. There are people who are also interested in family stories, in love stories.
That's another point, that not only is it a history of South Africa and the ANC and the breakdown of apartheid, it's also a love story.
Yes.
And it's really quite a remarkable story between Albertine and Walter. There are so many places where, even though you make it very factual and very straightforward, it just reaches out and touches you.
Yes, I've said too much also of the politician and and less of the novelist, where I could have perhaps focused more on the love story.
Oh, beautiful story. Would you tell us about children's books and reading? That's a passion of yours, isn't it? Would you talk about that?
Yeah, I've been involved with the Center for the Book in South Africa for a long time. And, you know, we've been very concerned about a weak reading culture, a lack of availability of books, lack of suitable books for black children, and in fact just generally that young people, many young people are reading less, and the influence of electronic media, television, computers, etc. And the fact that many schools don't have libraries, these are a whole range of things which interrelated issues which I'm concerned with, and which I got involved in after I wrote my children's book, The Day Gogo Went to Vote, which did very well in the U.S. and is widely available in libraries and shops in the U.S. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case in South Africa, and it's really due to an issue of economics. So, you know, I'm part of a network of people who are trying to make an impact on the book world and trying to encourage, to promote the writing of books, especially for children, and to mobilize resources to get books for children in disadvantaged communities.
That's a wonderful project. And how is it progressing?
Well, it's difficult. It's slow work. But I think there's a momentum which is building up slowly, and that will be getting somewhere. And so hopefully I can come back to you sometime in the future for some positive feedback.
Oh, that would be great. I think we are just about out of time on this. I definitely appreciate the time that you've taken, your interest in our little group, and I'm sure that Spiral Dynamics people will be very interested in your book as well. Where can they get copies of your book?
Okay, at the moment, they can get them off Amazon.com. or Kalahari.net. Kalahari.net is the South African equivalent of Amazon.com.
That's phenomenal. I wish you tremendous luck with the book. It's been a tremendous contribution that you've made to my knowledge and the knowledge of many people who are interested in equal rights, who are interested in social justice and politics in South Africa, and the broader dynamics of struggle in politics as well. And we wish you tremendous luck with it.
Yes, same to you, and hopefully next time I visit the U.S. I can come to your part of the world.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this, and thanks so much for your time, Eleanor. Best of luck to you.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.
We've been speaking with historian Eleanor Sisulu, an expert on South Africa's emergence out of apartheid. She's on a North American book tour, introducing her book, Walter and Albertina Sisulu, In Our Lifetime, to a U.S. audience. For more information on the Humergence Dialogues, visit us at www.spiraldynamics.org and www.clairewgraves.com.